WFYI podcast brought to you by Bloomington, Indiana, an American college town offering food and drink, college sports, outdoor activities, live music, cool art, and good times daily. Everyone is welcome in Bloomington. More information at visitbloomington.com.
We're going to take a trip right now. Like we always do about this time.
This is a journey into sound.
Break it down. I'm Kyle Long from Nuvo News Weekly, and you're tuned in to Cultural Manifesto, made possible in part by the Indianapolis Foundation, celebrating over 100 years of service. On tonight's show, I'll be previewing my favorite Indiana music festival, Bloomington's Lotus World Music and Arts Festival. Every year, dozens of the greatest musicians in the world descend on Bloomington for a weekend of unforgettable performances. And there are lots of great artists on this year's Lotus Festival lineup. I'll also be looking back at the case of Michael Taylor, a 16-year-old Indianapolis resident whose death in 1987 in the back of an Indianapolis Police Department patrol car continues to spark debate and outrage. I'll be speaking with the Indianapolis musician John Laughlin. In 1990, John co-wrote and recorded a reggae song titled Who Killed Michael Taylor with his band Reggaenomics. But first, let's kick off tonight's show with one of the artists that will be performing at Lotus Fest 2017 this weekend in Bloomington. Betsaida Machado was raised in the small village of El Clavo in the Barlovento region of Venezuela. And her music explores the Afro-Venezuelan rhythms and songs of her home. Betsaida's music addresses some of the most important socio-political issues in Venezuela, including gun violence, food shortages, and the country's history of slavery. We're going to listen to the track Sentimiento, and a quick translation of the voices you'll hear singing in the intro. I feel like crying, the way people are being killed in this beautiful country, and in my innocent town.
Yeah. este país, siendo un buen venezolano.
Me dan ganas de llorar, como matan a la gente, en este bello país, y en mi pueblo inocente. Me dan ganas de llorar, como matan a la gente, en este bello país, y en mi pueblo inocente.
I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. We just heard Betsaida Machado y La Paranda El Clavo. And Betsaida is one of dozens of great performers featured this weekend at Lotus Fest. And you can go to lotusfest.org for the full artist lineup. And I'll be previewing many more Lotus artists later in the show, but right now I want to switch gears for a moment. A lot of my work as a music journalist explores the idea of music as a form of protest or activism. During my time at Nuvo and WFYI, I've discussed this concept with a wide range of figures, from Black Panther Party co-founder Bobby Seale to U.S. Congressman Andre Carson to Public Enemy's legendary Chuck D. But tonight, I'm going to focus on a song I consider to be one of the most important protest songs to come out of the Indianapolis music scene. I'm talking about the 1990 recording, Who Killed Michael Taylor, by the Indianapolis band Reggaenomics. In just a moment, I'm going to share an excerpt of an interview I recorded with the song's author, John Laughlin. But first, I wanted to provide a brief setup. And we begin tonight at the merging point of two very different stories. One of those stories involves my guest, John Laughlin, who came of age in Fountain Square during the 1950s, listening to the country music and folk songs that dominated the white working class neighborhood where he grew up. By the 1980s, John had branched out from his country roots, and he began performing with Quasar, a group that's widely acknowledged as Indianapolis's first reggae band. Quasar attained a lot of notoriety in the Midwest, but eventually the group fizzled out, with several key members moving on to form Reggaenomics. And it was during his time with Reggaenomics that John began writing the song, Who Killed Michael Taylor? Which brings us to the second element of our discussion tonight. 30 years ago this month, on September 24, 1987, a 16-year-old Indianapolis resident named Michael Taylor was shot in the head while handcuffed with his hands behind his back in an Indianapolis Police Department patrol car. The police called Taylor's death a suicide, yet a 1996 civil suit refuted that claim and ordered the city of Indianapolis to pay Taylor's mother $4.3 million. The death of Michael Taylor sparked widespread outrage and protest in Indianapolis. And 30 years later, the Taylor case is still considered by many as an unforgivable miscarriage of justice. So in observance of the 30th anniversary of Michael Taylor's death, I'm sharing this excerpt of my interview with John Laughlin. And after we hear John explain his motivation for creating this song, we'll listen to the original 1990 Reaganomics recording of Who Killed Michael Taylor. And a quick disclaimer before we jump in, the views and opinions expressed in this segment don't necessarily reflect those of WFYI or the affiliate stations transmitting this broadcast. We pick up my conversation with John Laughlin as he describes the transition from Quasar to Reaganomics.
Baptiste wanted to start another group, and so me and Jim sided with Keith, and Keith came up with the name of Reaganomics. We thought that was wow, and we got a whole new, a different edge about things. It still was a conservative group. We didn't like go backstage and smoke a spliff with the audience. There wasn't that sort of, we may have, but it was individual, because some reggae groups would come through town. That was kind of what happens in the green room and other places. I'm saying that because both groups were not that political as they could have been, at, within the spirit of reggae in general. we were in Indianapolis, and we were slow to make sure we didn't alienate the status quo. Because Quasar had raised the level of reggae awareness to a level here that was unprecedented, and we were able to take it to the next level with the type of music we played.
And one of the things you're talking about, this the transition between Quasar and Reggaenomics and the differences in the groups, one of those differences would be the development of original material. You said Quasar was a cover band essentially doing reggae covers, but Reggaenomics, you guys wrote original songs, right?
Yes, we did do original songs. Quasar had played, we played the Wild Hare in Chicago. We played Cincinnati's Reggae Club. We played the Penrod Festival here. We toured, like I said, Texas, played in St. Croix. But it was all cover songs. Just nice, pleasant, don't scare anybody reggae. Because there was, you know, I Shot the Sheriff and these other songs that was more protest oriented. Looking out for the interests of the underdog and the oppressed groups, etc. That wasn't necessarily the theme of that. It was more commercial. That might be the term.
Sure.
But so yes, the Reaganomics did free up Keith and me and Tim to write.
And we're going to talk about some of those songs, particularly a song that you wrote, which is, I think, one of the biggest achievements in your career in music, was this song that you wrote about an incident here in Indianapolis. And we might as well go ahead and talk about that now. And this is coming off of, I have the tape right here. This is coming off a tape you made. Is it in 1980? Wait, what year was this? Let me see, make sure I'm getting that right. This is from a tape you recorded with Reaganomics in 1990. It's titled Rave, Reggae Roots, Reality. It's an EP. And you wrote a song on this EP called Who Killed Michael Taylor?
Yeah.
And for people of a certain age, that name immediately sparks recognition. But I think it'd be helpful if you gave a quick background on the Michael Taylor incident and its importance here in Indianapolis, if you'd like to do that.
Yeah, I would. This September will be the 30th anniversary of what I'm calling the murder. I was teaching at that time at the Arlington Skills Center. I was working for Clark College. I think it was like a Thursday, and the news was out that Michael Taylor, who was handcuffed in the back seat of a police car, shot himself with a .32 that the police implied at that time was in his chute. People were shocked at that. The recorder came out with a picture in the paper showing Michael Taylor standing by the police car down at, there were Virginia, South Street, Fletcher, and Southeast Street come together. He had, at that time, he had on like a tank top and shorts and sneakers with socks. And the recorder published this picture of him, and you could see that he didn't have anything in his, he didn't have a .32. That's for sure, in his shoe. He even had a blown-up picture of what he was wearing. And even the fact, Kyle, that when I saw that picture, and I think everybody had the same experience when the recorder came out with that the next Thursday, was why is he standing by a police car? Why are they taking a picture of this guy standing by a police car? I've never seen anything like that. So it was during the Circle City Classic as well, when his two historical black colleges play football here in Indianapolis. And so there's a lot of people in town. There had been several police shootings up to that time, but nothing ever happened to the police. Even the James Grimes November 1981 shooting, which I wrote another poem about, the Monument Circle poem, who was shot by a policeman on a circle. He and his wife pulled up next to the F&B bank there, which is next to the Columbia Club there on a circle, and he double parked, and his wife was going to go in and pay a payment because they were buying a house, and they wanted to let their in-laws know they were going to purchase a house. Officer Kress was his name, came up in this little Jeep that they had. I'll get back to Michael Taylor, but this is the James Grimes murder, if you will. I think Officer Kress said, you got to move, no double parking. And I think James Grimes said, well, they're double parking at the Columbia Club. Isn't that the Columbia Club? Yeah, because they were double parking forever at the Columbia Club, which is the place where the powerful elites go and eat and have spend there a long time. It's the kind of the house of the dominant Republican Party, and basically, and there was some disagreement. Evidently, Officer Kress went inside and tried to turn James Grimes' car off. James pushed on the gas. They started going around a circle. The cop pulled out a gun and shot him, killed him right there in front of his wife in the stomach, shot him there on the circle, claiming that James Grimes was heading towards one of these posts. Even something like that, where a man was murdered over like a $5 parking ticket or whatever, nothing happened. But this Michael Taylor incident, Kyle, was too much. It was too much. Plus the fact that Circle City Classic, a lot of people were in town. So they marched with a coffin. They carried a coffin and put it on the steps of the police station, whose door at that time was on Alabama, and placed that. The police were very concerned. They had cameras there on the basketball stadium, the Pacers College.
Market Square.
Thank you. And you could see the crowd down there, a big crowd. The next week they had the, it was on even Dan Rather on channel CBS News had that Friday, the story about this young man supposedly shot himself in the head with a .32 while he's handcuffed to a black police car, and it's where no one could see the gun on him, and the police had to search him. So I think the next week or the next week they had the police investigated it. The FBI came in. It came out in the wash that he killed himself. So at that laid low for a long time. It simmered. And there were still some police shootings after that, but nothing ever happened. And really we didn't find out the details until 9 years later in 96 when the Taylor family took this to court. And they took it to court out in Greenfield, east there on Washington Street. And they took it to a civil trial. And basically what happened was that a jury of six at a civil trial wasn't, the family was afraid to take it to a criminal trial of beyond a reasonable doubt with 12. They just took to a civil trial. And the jury said, basically, of white people, six white people, we don't know who killed him, but he didn't kill himself. Awarded the Taylor family like $4 million or so. But even though the policemen said they searched him more than twice and found a screwdriver, which they start steal cars with back then, and a cigarette lighter, they didn't find a gun. This .32. It's not a .22. You can see.
Right, right. It's a huge
next to the car. Yeah. It's a big gun. Now, nothing's been ever taken to criminal court. But like I said, the jury said, we don't know who killed him, but he didn't kill himself. And so the city lost that case. So I wanted to, at that time.
Right. So let me frame this. It's 1990. You're in this band, Reaganomics. It'd been 3 years since this happened, the death of Michael Taylor. There's lots of conflicting versions of what happened. The police say killed himself in the back of the car, handcuffed. The community, you know,
don't
after the black community, after years of witnessing this type of police abuse, you know, don't believe the official story. So you are in this band and you decide you want to write a song about it. Tell me about what moved you to create this song, Who Killed Michael Taylor, with Reaganomics.
The BS, obvious fact that this didn't happen. Also to put in the humanity of everybody involved.
You didn't write a song saying the police killed Michael Taylor. You wrote a song, Who Killed Michael Taylor? So you were taking, you certainly had a viewpoint on this that you wanted to share, but you kind of wrote it in an objective way, right?
Objective, I like that term, objective. I think due to my academic background, sociology and things like that, I saw issues involved. It's the system. The police weren't up there in some room thinking about doing this and making this happen or finding the case. No. And the mayor and everybody, they're a product of the system. It's a system that I wanted to get at. And that system created Michael Taylor. That system created the policeman. that system created everybody trying to not be responsible for something that's obviously blatantly a murder, and to maintain this Indianapolis veneer that everything, everybody gets along, we're a great place to live. So I think that was at the bottom of it, to try to help people understand whether it was suicide or homicide. It's just terrible. It's heartbreaking, and it's tragic, and everybody loses.
So you write this song, John, and this is a very inflammatory subject in 1990. There's a lot of, you know, to mention his name is to kind of make yourself a target, to kind of take up his cause publicly. And you bring this song to the band. How did they react? Did they say, we got to record this, we got to feature this song? Or you tell me, how did they react?
They were along in the process of me writing it. And I remember when we first did it at the Kilimanjaro Club, which was the place to start before that. We were nervous.
And now the Jazz Kitchen.
Yeah. We were nervous about doing it publicly because no one wanted to talk about the obvious, that they know he didn't shoot himself in the head with the .32 was in his shoe. We not only didn't see the gun in the pictures, but the police are trying to lie about it. And so, we were.
So you remember that first performance of this song at the Kilimanjaro Club on College, and what you were nervous?
Me and Tim, especially Tim, one of his family members was in the police department. And I was nervous.
What was the crowd's response when you performed it?
I don't remember. Probably was a quiet, because this is all new. And there's, you know, again, there's some authenticity in this, some moment in time when you do take your art and make it public, because they could have thrown stuff at us, could have walked out, any number, you know, that courage, if you will, to share your art. We had that, and I think the crowd liked it, obviously, because...
And you kept,
it got great reviews.
Yeah, you kept the song in your repertoire and performed it often and recorded it.
Did
you
put it on an album?
Yeah. Did you ever get any negative response from it in performances?
No, not that I know of. That's a good question. I didn't experience anything.
And the reviews of the album also commented on this song. It kind of, I think, is probably the most remarkable song, looking back, that the group recorded. It really retains its meaning and value, you know, as you said, almost 30 years after the murder of this young man. And the album's now, 27 years old now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you feel listening back on that track now?
I remember recording it. We were down at that.
And I should say, yeah, this album was recorded. It's Rave, Reggae, Roots, Reality. It's an EP, four-song EP that this appeared on. And it's recorded by Paul Mahern, mm-hmm. who is a founder of the Zero Boys, mm-hmm. and went on to become a very highly regarded producer, produced John Mellencamp.
Oh, he was good. He was good. That's why we went to him. Yeah. And that studio that's on 54th Street.
Hit City,
basement.
Is that where it was recorded?
Who?
Hit City, is that where it was recorded? Okay,
We decided to go at that level, and he helped us out a lot, and we all worked together. I think we did that over maybe 3 days.
I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. We just heard John Laughlin describe the circumstances in which he came to write and record the song Who Killed Michael Taylor with the band Reaganomics. We're going to listen to that song now, which originally appeared on the 1990 cassette-only release, Rave, Reggae, Roots, Reality by Reaganomics. And that group was getting a lot of attention at this time, performing for big audiences in Indianapolis at events like Black Expo, and this recording received positive reviews in national reggae music publications at the time. Reaganomics featured Keith Baptiste on vocals. Keith came to Indianapolis from Trinidad, and the group also included Michael Krug on drums, Milton Prince on vocals and percussion, Debbie Johnson on vocals and percussion, John Laughlin on vocals and keyboards, and Tim Johnson on lead vocals and percussion. And Tim Johnson is credited with co-writing Who Killed Michael Taylor with John Laughlin. Some of our listeners may recognize Tim by his current stage name, Kwanzaa Pops. This is Reaganomics with Who Killed Michael Taylor.
Newsflash, this just in. For every 10 young white men, 60 young black men will more likely die violent, often self-inflicted deaths. So
Suicide.
That was Reggaenomics with their 1990 track, Who Killed Michael Taylor? And this September marks the 30th anniversary of Michael Taylor's death in the backseat of an Indianapolis Police Department patrol car. Thanks to John Laughlin for sharing the backstory on this song. And you can catch my full interview with John on an upcoming edition of Cultural Manifesto. For the remainder of tonight's show, I'll be focusing on the Lotus World Music and Arts Festival, happening this weekend in Bloomington, Indiana. This year's Lotus Fest features over 24 incredible bands and performers from across the globe. And as we shift our attention away from Michael Taylor now, I want to play a song that was inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests against institutional racism and violence in the United States. Born of African-Caribbean descent in Quebec, Kaya Kater grew up in two musical worlds, the Canadian folk music of her home and the Appalachian music of West Virginia, where she has studied and lived. Kater performs on the banjo, and her music weaves together elements of traditional Appalachian culture with hard-hitting commentary on modern social issues. Kaya Kater will perform at Lotus Fest this Friday and Saturday night. You can also catch her at the free and family-friendly Lotus in the Park event on Saturday afternoon. Go to lotusfest.org for more information. From her 2016 album Ninepin, this is Kaya Kater with Rising Down.
In my
listening to Cultural Manifesto. Tonight's show is all about Lotus Fest, which is happening from Thursday, September 28th to Sunday, October 1st in Bloomington, Indiana. We just heard 2017 Lotus artist Kaya Kater. And now I want to play a track from a group I'm really looking forward to seeing this year. Trio Dakali came together for a project with the famed new music ensemble Kronos Quartet. The group unites three incredible musicians from southern Mali's Mande Griot tradition. You can catch Trio Dakali both Friday and Saturday night at Lotus. Let's listen to a track from their new album with Kronos Quartet. This is an amazing record, and we're going to listen to a cut called A Yaye. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. Tonight's show is all about Lotus Fest, which is happening this weekend in Bloomington, Indiana. And you can go to lotusfest.org to purchase advance tickets or find more information. And I open tonight's show with a fantastic track from the Afro-Venezuelan group Betsaida Machado y La Paranda El Clavo. And I want to play another track off their debut album. This is Pueblo de Fiesta.
Hoy mi pueblo está de fiesta, se siente gran emoción, y todo el mundo bailando al ritmo de esta canción. Hoy mi pueblo está de fiesta, se siente gran emoción, y todo el mundo bailando al ritmo de esta canción.
Te pones tu buena pista, te vas para la procesión, alumbrar a Santa Rosa, elevando una oración. Te pones tu buena pista, te vas para la procesión, alumbrar.
Listening to Cultural Manifesto. On tonight's show, we're sampling some of the artists performing at this year's edition of Lotus Fest in Bloomington, Indiana, Lotus Fest 2017 is happening from Thursday, September 28th to Sunday, October 1st. You can go to lotusfest.org for more information. There's such an incredible variety of music at Lotus Fest, and I want to move now to the Eurasian land of Georgia. The Iberi Choir is a 12-member group that performs traditional Georgian polyphonic song, which has been recognized by UNESCO as a masterpiece of intangible cultural heritage. The Iberi Choir will perform both Friday and Saturday night at Lotus, and we're going to listen to a song now from their 2014 album, First. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. Tonight's show is all about Lotus Fest, which is happening this weekend in Bloomington, Indiana. You can go to lotusfest.org for the full artist lineup. And I want to move back to Latin America now for a track from the Chilean accordionist and songwriter Pascual Ilabaca. She'll be performing at Lotus this Friday night. From the 2014 album Busco Paraíso, this is Pascual Ilabaca y Fauna with Carnaval de San Lorenzo. We'll I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. Tonight's show is all about Lotus Fest, which is happening this weekend in Bloomington, Indiana. And we have time for a couple more tunes, and I want to play a track now from Saba Motolebi. Saba Motolebi is a modern virtuoso of the tar and setar, lute-like stringed instruments central to Iranian music. She'll be performing at Lotus Fest this Friday and Saturday night. You can also catch her at the free and family-friendly Lotus in the Park event happening on Saturday afternoon. And you can find more information at lotusfest.org. From her 2011 album, Everlasting Songs from Iran, this is Saba Motolebi. That's all the time we have for tonight. Thank you for tuning in to this special Lotus Fest edition of Cultural Manifesto. You can purchase advance tickets and find the full Lotus Fest schedule online at lotusfest.org. We barely scratched the surface of all the amazing artists performing this year. There are over 24 performers and bands from across the globe participating in this year's festival. Let's bring things to a close with one more Lotus Fest 2017 artist. This is Wu Fei, a master of the 21-string Chinese zither known as guzheng. I'm Kyle Long, and you've been listening to Cultural Manifesto, made possible in part by the Indianapolis Foundation, celebrating over 100 years of service.